Well, thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me. I don't have any commercial relationships to disclose. I'm going to talk a little bit about the global picture of what's driving my forces in immigration, the scale of which is really overwhelming to most authorities, including WHO and the IOM, the International Organization for Migration. It's very complex. Many, many people search work to better their lives, but there are also asylum seekers, refugees from wars, from violence, and so on, which are not necessarily voluntarily moving from their country. No? So climate change, violence, all the things that you already know. More than almost 200 million people live outside of their birthplace, according to this report from 2007. Obviously, both economic and demographic realities are important all over the world, especially in developed world. Birth rates are declining and populations are aging. So, for example, in 2050, Italy will have fewer people. Today, Italy has 3.7 workers for every person over 65. By 2050, that will be 1.5. So they will need people, and that draws immigrants. In the U.S., there's 5.7 workers for every person over 65. By 2050, it will drop to 2.7. And we see that in nurses and other health professionals. So declining populations. And here you see the issue of nurses and physicians and other medical personnel who migrate from their birthplace to other countries. Consequences of denying the health care: increased potential for the spread of infectious disease if the needs are not met, increasing costs in emergency care, even though many countries restrict access to health, irregular immigrants and asylum seekers included, and there are some who exclude altogether migrants from health services. Some countries, migrant health has been a subject of great attention, and some it's kind of on the back burner. Components of good migrant care. There was a study done in about 16 countries in the European region which gives us an idea of what they constitute good practice, and then we'll show some examples of not so good and maybe better practices. Health professionals here talked about, obviously, the services were primary health care, accident emergency care, and community health services. And they were very similar, what they said from each of these 16 countries. The views were very consistent. It was like, it requires sufficient resources, which is important. Most of these services don't have sufficient resources, and it doesn't mean only economic ones, it's also human resources. And organizational flexibility, a positive attitude from everyone. Training, definitely training, and providing sufficient information and services such as translation because of language and cultural issues. No? So I'll tell you a little bit about good practices. I started talking about best practice, and then I realized there are really none really best practices. They're kind of good potential. And Costa Rica has always been the one that everybody talks about. No, it's a small country. Less than 5 million people. The life expectancy is higher than in the U.S., and the expenditures in health is much less than in the U.S. So let's say the Social Security, La Caja, spends about $800 per capita per year. They were challenged by the Nicaraguan immigration. They really challenged because a lot of people came into Costa Rica. The Nicaraguans do make a contribution to the economy. They recognize that. They take jobs that the Costa Ricans do not want, much as in the U.S., but their numbers really strain social resources, especially health resources. The environment from the 90s up until 2004 was very good. The environment in general in Costa Rica is pretty good for people to live in. They have clean water, basic sanitation, etc. But the urban pressures, expanding, strain agricultural resources and the use of pesticides and what have you present a lot of threats to public health. So much so that in 2004, Costa Rica passed a law excluding undocumented immigrants from their national health systems. So, next good practice, Finland. Finland has extensive experience using national registry to keep track of health professionals in the country. Service structure reform anticipates workforce demand, recognizes health professionals' qualifications, their use in monitoring stocks and flows of health workforce. They have fair recruitment practices, equal opportunities for migrant health personnel, long-term workforce forecasting, retention policies, demographic projections influencing health expenditures and anticipating educational needs for healthcare workers, especially nurses. So this system does include migrant workers, undocumented or not. Another one is, for instance, Colorado has an interesting good practice called, it's a nonprofit, Salud Familia Health Centers. It meets the healthcare needs of farm workers and their families in about 14 clinics in 9 communities. With primary health care services, it reduces barriers to health care by working at the community level, I imagine, it didn't say, with promotoras. They have the ability to pay, transportation, language, translation, etc. High quality, comprehensive care. Many migrants, they don't ask for papers, and they've been working quite well in these clinics, both in public health and in medical care. Canada has an interesting practice. The treatment provides, in general, a general practitioner free of charge, registering as a temporary patient. They can be in the area. They need to be more than 24 hours and less than 3 months. Services free of charge, irrespective of country of residence or of origin, include emergency treatment, ambulatory services, subsequent outpatient appointments, family planning, treatment of communicable diseases, including sexually transmitted diseases, HIV counseling, and mental health treatment as part of a court order. So if someone was arrested and went to jail. New Zealand has an interesting also primary health care system for indigenous groups. And I thought this was an interesting example because they're not immigrants, but we sometimes forget that the indigenous in many countries are treated sometimes even worse than migrants, no? So it's a free service for the Maori. They have hospital, general practice. It's a very friendly environment. The clinic is located in this area that's a sacred meeting place of the Maori, so they feel at ease and culturally accepted. And so this is an interesting service in New Zealand, that, and this ambulance, you may or may not see that it says free ambulance on the side of it. University of Connecticut Health Center has an annual Migrant Farm Worker Symposium. They provide valuable information about the migrant farm workers to educators, health professionals, etc. The variety of services they provide are dental and medical clinics, common diagnosis, impact of occupational pesticide health issues. So we have this situation in the U.S., and you've heard a whole lot more about it. Immigrants are almost 40% of workers in the farming industry, forestry, fishing, about 20% construction, and 21% in the service industry. This means greater output of the economy. A lot of people don't see that part of it. The biggest winners being the employers, they get more productivity for less cost, the owners of capital and land and managers. And sometimes this is not shown enough for our legislators to understand. So illegal immigrants work for almost exclusively in the lowest paid jobs, their least desirable jobs, things people don't want to do, the regular people in those communities don't want to do. They don't compete with American workers. There's an institute in Arizona that has a lot of very interesting studies about this. The legal immigrants do, especially the health and highly skilled health professionals. They do compete. Well, another thing that most people don't understand, and I'm not talking about the ones in this room because I think we're just about all of us the converters, yeah, is that taxpayers are paying for the undocumented migrants' health care anyway when they go to the emergency rooms, and they're paying for it about 300 times more than they would if they had regular services. And this has been so since the time, I think, of President Kennedy, even before, and Lyndon B. Johnson. So when an illegal immigrant receives emergency care, Medicaid reimburses the hospital. Somebody has to reimburse the hospital for the care, right? Lawmakers struggle to come to some consensus on this issue, but health care seems to be central to the disagreement, especially who pays for the health care, oblivious that we're already paying for the health care, right? So world leaders, this World Health Assembly in May of this year came together to look at the latest report from the International Organization of Migration, and they're discussing this issue. The Minister of Health from Italy signed an agreement with the regional office in Europe on a three-year project to look at how to provide better care for migrants in Europe. This is the report from the international organization, and you can see it. It's online. I'm not going to go much into it. On the U.S. border, the deaths have increased, especially in Texas and in Arizona, the desert. Many, many thousands of men and women and children are dying there, while Congress is still discussing other things, knowing full well that the policies that the Border Health Patrol is implementing is contributing to this, right? Some examples in Hidalgo County, where they have the highest uninsured, now about one in three people without insurance, they have diabetes care through some of the Promotores Network, this project called Saber, that has been implemented by UT Pan Am, has been quite successful in helping people deal with and prevent risks of diabetes without going into the emergency room. Illegal Mexicans have received vaccination with consulates. This is the story of the El Paso Mexican consulate, as well as aid tests and other things. And they also go into New Mexico because the consulate there covers quite a wide. They have the health windows that experience mostly providing information of where people could go. So the U.S. is not alone in the immigration issue. Europe, Australia, Canada, the rest of the developed world faces these challenges. There's that anti-immigration discriminatory message, much of it through the media, when in fact immigration has been here since the beginning of time. I mean, you could see the maps of people immigrating from Italy to the U.S., from Spain, from Norway, from Germany, etc. No? So denial of the health insurance and the laws that create tiers of people really doesn't help. Denying access to health care politicizes people's bodies and they get disenfranchised and, to a certain extent, even dehumanized. It's important to understand how migrants are treated internationally, and it gives a context to the political situation. It could happen to citizens of the U.S. When they go abroad, and I think many citizens of the U.S. have found some not so pleasant experiences when they go to other countries, because eventually everyone can be an immigrant somewhere. So this is the resolution from the World Health Organization in 2008. To look at the health of immigrants and to support and provide technical cooperation to member states, right? And in 2010, the global consultation also provided some information about the consensus reached by these are the health ministers of the world. So equity and solidarity is important. Avoid disparities in health status. This is basically the issues in the resolution. Ensuring that discrimination and stigmatization is limited. Implementing life-saving interventions. Minimizing the negative health outcomes of migration. This is the public health approach. You've probably seen that. Ensuring health rights. Reducing excess morbidity and mortality. Building partnerships between countries that both send out or expel migrants and those who receive the migrants. And the University of California has this symposium every year that provides a forum for discussion of how to improve the situation. And there's a paradigm shift that the WHO suggests, that we go from this traditional approach of exclusion, of looking more at security than at development and at disease control, and a national focus on security rather than on human security, to a more modern inclusion, reduction of inequalities, and a multi-country development of policies. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. Great. So we have only a limited time, so I'm really anxious to hear questions from the audience. I'm going to ask one or two brief questions, and I'd love to have a brief response from folks, and then as you're thinking through questions, so we'll really just do two quick questions, I think. First, I think most people were recognizing the limitations of both the Affordable Care Act. Jenny, you mentioned immigration reform, not providing a solution to the challenge of healthcare for the undocumented. Let me put that a little bit back on the panel rather than, you know, begrudging the world we live in. Why do you think, maybe Daniel, you could start off, why do you think there is the opposition that we've seen? Right, started in the Affordable Care Act, but it was definitely a flashpoint in immigration reform. Why do you think there is opposition to this? And then to bring in Nadira, you were going to reference how California is actually moving in a positive direction. We just had Jerry Brown at the Center for American Progress talking about the change in attitudes in immigration on immigration in California. So then maybe you could respond with what positive steps are being taken in California, and how did Californians make that switch? So Daniel, do you want to start, and maybe Jenny?
Sure.
I don't know. We could try to project.
Can you hear me when I'm talking?
Okay.
We can.
That's it. Why don't you get going,
yeah,
and we'll work on it while
I think what we've observed is that money plays a role. We know that was a reason given oftentimes for not including certain.
You gotta talk up. You might want to get on here because there's people in the back.
All right, is this better? Okay, so I was saying I think that it boils down to money. And oftentimes what we've observed is that, we obviously don't have the money to do everything. And so with limited means, what are we going to do? And that's what it boils down to. And I think the other answer that I would give, it really boils down to politics and the fact that a lot of our lawmakers come from districts that might not appreciate the issues impacting people with disabilities, despite the trends that we see happening. And so I think it's incumbent upon all of us to educate and inform them about these changes. That's my one.
Oh, quick. Very good. Very quick. Jenny, do you want to add?
I don't have much to add to that. I agree with that.
Okay.
Well, I think I was going to sort of describe some of the laws. I don't know
Go
whether
ahead.
There's really any point going over them. Just the fact that in California, the policy environment seems to be more positive. And, thinking about why that might be, part of it may have to do with the fact that the undocumented population, you hear when people who are undocumented talk about these issues, they are talking about the fact that, you have a lot of mixed status families in the state, so it is your family members you're talking about. It's not some stranger that's just coming in to your community. It's part of the fabric of the community, and that may be inherently why the population would be more receptive to thinking of the undocumented as one of your own. There's just the difference is really the documentation status.
All right, do we have questions? Great. So that's great. We have a bunch of questions. Why don't we start in front and just state your name, try to project so everyone can hear you.
Providers, and in particular, you, Dr. Cora, have noted about 25% of people who are undocumented saying that
going to try to speak really loud. It is a good question. You know, this is a self-respondent survey that people responded to, and there could be inaccuracies, though we try to ask the question repeatedly and in different forms. People could still misreport. The bigger question you're bringing up is very important. What's going to happen to the safety net once health care reform takes a lot of the uninsured population and insures them, and then you are left with a population that is not going to get insurance, don't have the opportunities to have it, and the mandate of the safety net clinic is to provide care to the population that's left uninsured. So, and then you can, you know, this could be ammunition in the hands of those that are responsible for providing the funds to the safety net clinics. It's a catch-22. It's not a good situation. And you know, what the policy answer is, I'll defer to people who actually are thinking about policy all the time.
I would just add that it's going to be a fight at the local level and it's a fight at the national level. And you see with the Affordable Care Act, I mean, funding for the safety net does decrease. The DSH funding for hospitals decreased because of this assumption that more people are going to get coverage. I would say, so I mean, it's something we have to fight. It's something folks are fighting at their states and in their counties and nationally, too, and we need to continue to do that. What I don't think is helpful is talking about the residual uninsured as being an undocumented immigrant problem. Politically, I mean, it's not true, first of all. There are 25%, even before if Medicaid had been expanded to all states, still 25% of the uninsured would be undocumented. That's not the majority of the uninsured population. And so I think it's important that when we're talking about the uninsured and the need for the safety net, it's not because it's going to be, I mean, it's true, a lot of people are undocumented. We need to find a solution to this, but politically, it's not helpful to go there. We need to be making the case for the entire safety net.
Great. Question right there, gentleman right there. Yep, go ahead.
The private insurance number that I showed is a combination of private purchase as well as job-based coverage. And, you know, the undocumented profile is probably more consistent with working in smaller firms, though there are those that are working in large firms and do have coverage. How that's possible, you know, I don't know exactly. You know, it is possible because people are reporting it. Are some of the small employers are going to actually discontinue? That's actually a bigger question. Yes, it's possible that some employers may not cover, and it could exacerbate the situation. Though I haven't seen any estimates as how many are likely to do that and what impact is going to be on the undocumented.
The current rates of small business insurance are low and getting lower. So the rates of insurance provision, I mean, it differs from state to state, for small businesses is pretty, you know, it's pretty low. It can be as low as 10 to 25% based on the state. So I could see that issue of churn, but it would not be, I mean, there are not that many small businesses today, sad to say, that are providing health insurance at the 25 and under level. Question in the back? There's a lot of Californians here today. The rest of the country has to step up.
One of the things I do is manage the 800 number where people in our town are called who don't have connections to health insurance. And one of the questions I was interested in finding out about was whether the dental is going to have more support or less support for some of these particularly adults.
You mean is dental covered in the ACA or for uninsured?
Well, it's Medi-Cal, or what we call Medicaid in California, Medi-Cal, adults are going to get some limited coverage, and it's middle of next year that it's not this part of it.
So if I could tell you that my wife is a dentist, I'm very sensitive to that issue. And I'll tell you, I can never project, so let me use the mic. But I will tell you that during the ACA, there was, I don't know if you remember the story of Diamante Driver, the young child that had, and so there was a push on the ADA, the NDA, and other associations representing dentists to include that, to at least allow for pediatric dental services in the health insurance exchange and the essential health benefits package. Same thing with Medicaid. So there was no real desire to include adults in that. They didn't get that support from the larger association. So I would say that that is definitely a piece of the advocacy that we have to continue as we move forward. But I agree with you. And I will tell you that seniors, a lot of seniors will come to me and say, well, gee, I need to get, my removables or whatever, and they can't get it. So I agree with you. That is an issue.
Any more questions? I saw one. Oh, good. Two over here. If you're not from California, that's...
So there was this recognition that that did take it a little too far, that what happened in the ACA was a little too far. So I think that's possible. How meaningful that is for low-income immigrants to be able to buy at full price in the exchange, I'm not, we still have some work to do. The five-year bar is tricky. There was the last, in Medicaid, we're talking about Medicaid and CHIP, there's no five-year waiting period for the ACA subsidies. We did have a big achievement with the reauthorization of the CHIP program in 2009.
Yes.
And so that gave states the option to take away the five-year bar for kids and pregnant women and to increase access to this broader group of lawfully present kids and pregnant women instead of just a smaller group. So I think this idea of a state option, especially now that Medicaid is a state option to expand in states, this idea of Medicaid as being, as expansions of coverage being an option for states with federal assistance, I think is possible. So maybe doing a state option to get rid of the five-year bar for adults as well as for kids could be politically palatable. I think anything more than state options in this environment is going to be very hard.
Yeah, so I worked on the issue of immigration and the ACA, and I think the one thing to be mindful of is that all of these things are subject to shifts in time. In 2009, we were going through a kind of, the bill started, and then there was a big Tea Party reaction to the bill, and they lobbed, obviously, I think we all remember, Joe Wilson saying, telling the president he lied. There was a big reaction that hit on the issue of immigration, and the bill became, became punitive and not allowing people to buy into the exchange. Obviously, we saw in the Senate that switched, which Jenny referenced. So, I think California is actually illustrative of how things shift on the issue of immigration. 20 years ago, it was one of the most punitive states in the country. I remember Prop 187, et cetera. Now, there's just a very different attitude. So I think these are issues to hit on a regular basis, because within a year, 2 years, it might take longer. Attitudes on these issues have shifted. Obviously, the attitude towards immigration reform dramatically shifted in the course of 24 hours after the election last year. So I think, you know, we haven't gotten the bill through the House, but you got a lot of Republicans in the Senate who did not support it a year before. So I do think these are issues that continually need people to focus on and to remind people that undocumented immigrants are a source of strength to the country, not a burden. That is essentially the switch people need to make to actually address these issues going forward, to actually recognize that they should be helping them in healthcare reform, not hurting them, helping them in immigration reform, not hurting them. That's the switch that lawmakers need to make. She was before you, I apologize. You want to stand up? And I'm really hoping you're not from California, but it's okay if you are. No, keep going.
Texas has nothing to say.
That's a great point for us to. Do we have time? Oh, unfortunately, we are out of time. I very much appreciate the panelists and all their great. Let's give them a round of applause.